From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we hear from Detroit's new school superintendent.
We're going to revamp programming, expand programming, to not only retain and recruit new parents, but engage a group of parents that aren't even thinking about our public school system right now.
Plus, it's another uphill battle to expand Michigan's civil rights protection to gay and transgender people.
We have not even a single Republican that has stepped forward to indicate his or her support for this.
The true story of the Underground Railroad in Michigan.
People in Michigan were outright vocal about their anti-slavery activists. You have people in Washtenaw County putting a sign in their yard saying, you know, people are welcome here.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's certainly been a high-speed first few days on the job for Detroit's new school superintendent. Nicolai Viti began his new job last Tuesday and jumped right in with school visits, meeting and talking with teachers, parents, and staffers. Today, he was part of a panel discussion at the Mackinac Policy Conference, and he's taking time out now to be with us from Mackinac Island. Superintendent Nicolai Viti, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
So you come from Florida, but we should remind everyone you were born and raised in Metro Detroit in Dearborn Heights, so this is a homecoming for you, isn't it?
This is. It's just not a day goes by where I'm just excited to be back home and doing the work where I think it's needed most, which is in the city that I love, which is Detroit.
There are so many issues and problems that have plagued Detroit public schools for years, and it has to be a daunting task to do triage and organize your priorities. But I read your 100-day plan, so it's clear you are beginning by meeting and talking with stakeholders at every level. I'd like to start with teachers. You've got 260 vacant teaching jobs to fill. Why should a teacher come to Detroit? What's your sales pitch?
Well, I think it's rather clear in that if someone is thinking about the teaching profession and they want to go to a place where they'll never wake up a day wondering what they're doing or why they're doing it, then Detroit is the place to teach. I don't think there's anywhere in the country, and that's not an exaggeration. I don't think there's anywhere in the country where you can go where you'll see the immediate impact of your work. And I think with so many jobs in today's economy and even other teaching opportunities, you may wake up wondering, why am I doing this? And am I really making a difference? And it is a long-term, long impact as far as the difference. And I think teaching in Detroit, you'll never wonder why you go to work every day.
Now, how close are you to finalizing a contract with teachers?
I think we're closer than far away. And I think it's just a matter of some details that have to be agreed upon. And I'm hoping that that contract is resolved and agreed upon in the next couple of weeks. It will provide a bump to teacher salaries, but it's not a long-term solution. We know that our teachers in Detroit deserve much more than they'll even get in this contract agreement. And I'm looking forward to working through the budget process to seeing where there's some opportunities long-term so that we can increase salaries to a point where we outcompete surrounding suburban districts.
And as you talk to principals and administrators, what are you saying to them about possible changes in the curriculum in Detroit schools?
Well, you know, the standards changed a couple years ago. And in talking to principals, it's very clear that our curriculum right now is outdated, not necessarily aligned to the highest level, to the standards. I'm not looking to make changes going into this school year regarding curriculum, but we are going to engage teachers and principals about curriculum options and then hopefully move forward with new adoptions for the 18-19 school year.
And parents, if I'm a DPSCD parent right now, boy, do I want some stability. So how do you see your role and your ability to keep parents from pulling their kids out and sending them to a charter school or to another district or to a private school?
Well, our main focus right now is improving the educational product, the educational experience for the 46,000 students that we currently have in the system. We have to own the experience of those students now. And I think if we focus on those students now and they start to experience something new, different, fresher, And they obviously will come home and talk to their parents about that. Parents see that. The word of mouth will travel. And I think parents will come back to the school system who have left. And then as that process continues, we're going to revamp programming, expand programming to not only retain and recruit new parents, but engage a group of parents that aren't even thinking about our public school system right now. And I think there's an opportunity to do that, which is offering unique programming that you would only get in our school system, especially in the area of special education.
Money certainly ties into that stability. As a superintendent, you know that. And the district has said it really didn't get what it needed in the bailout deal with Lansing. How do you see yourself handling that and working with the governor and the state lawmakers who control those purse strings?
Well, I think it's more than anything, we have to ensure that people are building their confidence in our financial management. I think this year was a positive year in that regard, and Interim Superintendent Meriwether deserves credit for that, including the CFO and the school board. So I think we have to continue in the years to come to show financial stability, good management of dollars, but we also have to move to use dollars more strategically and efficiently, aligned to a strategic plan. One of the immediate short-term goals that I will have is to bring a strategic plan to the board, which will drive our budget and our way of work. I say all of that to then answer a question, is I think if we continue to be financially efficient and transparent with our dollars, I think we can broaden the conversation with Lansing and have it be a driven, data-driven conversation about where we stand financially, demonstrate the things that we've done, the things that we're going to do. And I do believe that people will recognize that there may need to be additional resources in Detroit. I think that's clearly already known, but to create the credibility to actually receive additional dollars will have to come with an increase in confidence in what we're currently doing.
Superintendent Vitti, one of the problems you inherited is the fact that the State School Reform Office began this year by releasing a list of 38 low-performing schools that could be closed for chronically poor performance, and most of them were in Detroit. What is your thought on this? Should low-performing schools be eventually closed if they don't turn around in a specific time period?
Well, I don't think that should be the immediate solution. I think we all understand that when you close a school, you rip at a fabric of the community, and you frankly create craters in the community, and it creates yet another incentive for people not to live in that community or neighborhood. And you don't have to see that beyond Detroit and drive through neighborhoods and see the devastation that has occurred economically through the city, but with closed schools that lead people to leave those areas. With all that said, I think we need to demand improvement, but incremental and solid improvement. And I commend the state superintendent for devising a plan that allows us to demonstrate improvement, but also giving us time to do that. When we look at capacity in our schools, enrollment in our schools, the age of our facilities, residential rates, and the number of school-age children in certain communities, we will have to right-size the district as far as capacity, consolidation of schools, new schools. And that's something that we'll start doing soon as far as an analysis concerned, engaging the community on what that looks like. And I can see in the next 2 to 3 years making some hard decisions. But initially, I think we need to be given time to show improvement before any schools are closed.
I understand your main message coming out of today's panel at the Mackinac Policy Conference was big changes are coming, but not really until 2018, 2019?
Well, I think that that's correct, I think, as an overall message. But there will be some changes made by June 30th. All administrators are on for the most part, a one-year contract. There are a couple of exceptions, and I do believe that between now and June 30th, there can be some adjustments made to the current organizational structure, primarily at the district level, to free additional resources to expand programming in schools, provide additional support maybe in the area of attendance and transportation possibly. And so there will be some adjustments at the administrative level at the district. Those changes won't be profoundly impacting the schools. There won't be many changes to principals at all as we go into the next year. But I think people will see a district office that is leaner, thinner, and hopefully more agile and supportive of what's happening in classrooms and the schools. I also think there's an opportunity to take a look at the number of teachers that are certified and available to work in schools and classrooms that are currently out of the classroom. Those are district-level coaches and some school-level coaches that maybe could go back into the school setting or the classroom setting to help our vacancy challenge into next school year. That's where you're going to see the major changes, at least going into this fall. I think it would be inappropriate to make massive changes going into the fall when the budget is essentially built and many decisions have already been made linked to initiatives and projects.
As you put this together, have you decided where to send your children to school?
I feel comfortable in saying that our children will be in the school system. We're investigating and trying to find the right fit for each of our children. As I've said, my only hesitation to guaranteeing that they'll be there is that two of my children have individual education plans or IEPs, so they do have special needs, and I just want to make sure that those can be addressed in the schools that we would be likely to send our children. That's my only hesitation at this point, but I do believe between now and the fall, we'll figure that out.
Nicolai Viti, the new superintendent of the Detroit Public Schools Community District. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today on Stateside.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A slap in the face of good governance that puts our health and environment at great risk. That's what my next guest has to say about President Trump's proposed budget cuts to EPA funding. The White House wants to basically zero out the budget for the EPA's vehicle lab in Ann Arbor. Just what is this lab and why should we care how it's funded? Dave Cook is a senior vehicles analyst in the Clean Vehicles Program with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and he is with us now via Skype. Dave, why is cutting funding to the EPA's vehicle lab such a bad idea?
There's two main reasons why cutting funding to the vehicle lab is really problematic. You know, there are two roles it plays. On the one hand, it's the watchdog for every vehicle that is sold to American consumers. So, you know, it's responsible for certifying that the fuel economy, you know, matches the label so consumers know what they're getting, and it's responsible for ensuring that each vehicle meets, you know, appropriate pollution controls. On the other hand, it also is responsible for a lot of the fundamental research in the automotive space that folks like myself, who don't have access to $1 million facility, you know, millions of dollars of research equipment, can then use and really try to understand what's going on in this space.
So it's important for consumers and auto companies.
Exactly.
Exactly what is happening at that lab? We drive by it in Ann Arbor and see this laboratory space, this EPA space. But what is actually going on there?
There's a wide range of activities going on there. They do a lot of testing on a dynamometer, which you can think of as basically a treadmill for a car. So it simulates what a vehicle would act like on a road, but they can do it in a controlled environment. And so you have repeatable tests, and that's how you get these sort of standardized test procedures, and that's how you make sure that, you know, each vehicle is meeting the required emissions, et cetera. So it's got a large number of these test cells, and so they're constantly churning out new data, making sure that each vehicle that's sold is meeting its appropriate checks. It's also, though, doing, you know, there's a lot of number crunching that goes into and a lot of modeling work that draws upon this data that they're collecting so that we can, you know, look at regulations for the future and think about where technology is heading, you know, and how we can continue to improve the technology development and increase that, you know, general knowledge base.
And that, because it's the EPA, it is, in essence, of the public, as opposed to maybe people who would say, well, why can't the auto companies do these tests?
Exactly. And actually, you know, the funding for the lab is, so when it comes to the tests on, you know, the sort of the regular, the emissions controls, they spot check vehicles. They already do not have the funding to check the 1,000 different configurations of a vehicle that hits the lot. They already only check between, you know, 15% and 20%. And a lot of this testing is already being done at manufacturers. And then what you see is, you know, how you have instances like Ford having to adjust its labels because its test results didn't match what EPA had. And so, you know,
or that little EPA, that little issue with Volkswagen and the cheating on its diesel emissions.
Exactly. And that is a perfect example of actually that required additional like on-road testing to actually verify what was going on. You know, they had figured out a way to game the standardized lab tests. And instead, what it took was additional complementary testing that we would like to see more of, but is actually much more time consuming and more expensive. And so it's we're going in this budget goes in the exact opposite direction, you know, where we should be promoting even more rigorous testing, which does require more resources. You know, this budget goes in the opposite direction.
Seems to me that the president's budget is calling for the vehicle lab to be funded almost totally by fees charged to the industry.
Yeah, that's the proposal in there. But in effect, EPA already collects some of these fees, and it's up to Congress to appropriate them. And to date, they have not appropriated them back to the lab. And instead, those fees have been used toward general deficit reduction. So the fund is upwards of like $300 million in fees that should have, you know, that in principle was designed to go to the lab. And is now, you know, is just held in the general budget. And what the current proposal is to increase that fee so that it covered all of the costs. But there's no guarantee. It would still require Congress to appropriate that. And obviously, history shows that they have not and would likely not. And that would effectively shut down the lab.
Now, you say cuts to this vehicle lab, EPA's vehicle lab, would really hobble auto companies' ability to put out the best new products and mess up rollout times?
Yeah, I mean, that would be a big concern, is that you would have two potential consequences if you significantly reduce the resources and staff at the EPA lab. You know, it would just take longer for a vehicle to get certified because now you have fewer people, fewer resources being able to test the same, you know, meet the same benchmarks, or the benchmarks would be reduced. And that would be a terrible outcome, but it could become that the EPA is more of a rubber stamp for the industry. And obviously, when you have an industry that has issues like Volkswagen, you have the label cheating of Hyundai Kia, you know, you have ongoing issues with Fiat Chrysler, that's exactly what the American public would not want.
And is that why we really haven't heard the auto companies speaking out in favor of keeping the funding for the vehicle lab?
The few quotes that I've seen from the auto industry has been like, we don't want to do anything that would increase certification time. And, you know, having a standard process that all automakers have to meet, you know, promotes a level playing field. And so we would expect that the auto industry wants to make sure that all of its companies are abiding by the same strict rules, and a rubber stamp process would, you know, adversely impact that level playing field. You know, you have people who would try to take advantage of the situation. So from pure competitiveness reasons, we would have expected them to really push for maintaining a strong, rigorous process and a strong lab.
We know the president's budget is a proposal, and what actually happens depends on Congress. So what's at stake here?
We're hopeful that this is not in any way what gets past Congress, but the real issue is that this is a signal in exactly the wrong direction. You know, we need to be bolstering our safeguards, not reducing them. And the fact that the president's budget is pushing in the wrong direction is problematic in general. But obviously, we hope that Congress makes the right decision.
Dave Cook is with the Clean Vehicles Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dave, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Poetry is good food. That's the lesson award-winning writer Peter Marcus has been teaching to kids in Detroit for years. He taught creative writing in the Detroit Public Schools, and he's the senior writer with the Inside Out Literary Arts Project. It places writers in public schools to hold creative writing workshops. In his latest book, Inside My Pencil, Peter Marcus tells the true stories of the power of poetry and writing to change a child's way of looking at the world and at himself or herself. Peter Marcus, welcome to Stateside. So good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
When you say to your students that poetry is good food, what do you mean by that?
I just believe that we need to make more time in our lives for poetry. You know, I think we eat poetry. There's a poem by Mark Strand that I teach and I make reference to in the book that, you know, when we delight in language, I think it can transform our experience into a richer experience in the world. So poetry, you know, I'm playing with the old Campbell's soup motto that soup is good food, but I also think poetry and I think our classrooms, our educational system in general just needs to make more space in itself for language, poetry, even more so creativity, the imagination.
And this is something that you've been really fighting to bring into classrooms, especially working in Detroit. Tell us more about the kids who are in your classes. What do you want us to understand about these Detroit students that we meet in your book?
I mean, one thing I've always discovered in doing what I do is that if you give a child an opportunity to dream, he will dream. If you give her an opportunity to imagine, she will imagine. If you tell that same child to grow up, sit down, they're going to shut down. So I come in, you know, loving what I do, saying there's no right or wrong way to do it. Let's have some fun. I'm going to put you in situations where you're going to succeed, in a place where too often children are placed in situations to fail. And then all of a sudden they do succeed. I can write a poem. I can be creative. I can say something that Mr. Pete is like, wow, I've never heard it said in such a way. That's beautiful.
The magic inside their pencil.
There you go. And all of a sudden then you're starting to breed confidence. And out of confidence comes success. And out of that success, they want to keep on doing it. And that's these children can do it as long as you create an opportunity for them to do it. If you don't give them the opportunity to do it, you know, they're going to do something else.
Now, what do you say or do for the kid who looks at that pencil and said, oh, there's nothing but lead inside that pencil, the super realist kid?
I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. I said, no problem. Let's look again. You know, we've got two eyes. At first, we look with the right eye. It didn't work. No problem. Let's try again. It's okay to fail, right? It's okay to say, well, let's, you know, I didn't see anything, Mr. Pete. Okay, look again with your left eye. And a lot of times that kid might say, you know, and I respect that sort of resistance. You know, no, I didn't see anything this time. All I saw was that little rubbery eraser. Okay, well, how about this? You know, when you close your eyes at night, sometimes we dream and you see the visual world behind your dreams, behind your eyelids. Close your eyes. Let's place that pencil up to, you know, our forehead. What do you see there? Or what do you wish you could see? If you're not seeing anything, what do you want to see?
You just want to uncork it. You know, you want to get that imagination.
You uncork the bottle.
Yeah.
Guess what comes out? The genie, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they'll see it. Eventually, I mean, I've run into resistance. But by the time I get to that third eye, you know, and everybody else in the room has sort of been relishing in the delight of the imagination, even the more resistant child is going to say, yeah, I think I saw something that time. Okay, what did you see? Then you start asking questions, and out of questions comes these very wonderful answers.
I'm talking with Peter Marcus, writer, about his newest book, Inside My Pencil, Teaching Poetry in the Detroit Public Schools. With that in mind, I'd love if you would read us a couple of your students' poems from your book. I know there was one called Poetry Lives by Troy Nana Barnett, and I thought it was a great example of what you've been able to help these kids realize.
I'd love to read that poem. And it's a poem that I continue to bring into the classroom to inspire other poems that respond to the question that I ask, which is, where does poetry live? Humans live in houses and condos and sometimes in their cars or even under bridges. Mm-hmm. Birds live in trees, in nests made out of twig and mud. Sometimes they even live in the marsh on the ground. Fish live in ponds, lakes, rivers, fish tanks. Where does poetry live then? And this is what she wrote. Poetry lives in the strings of a guitar, the peak of a mountain. Poetry lives in the sass of a girl's walk, the wishes of a dying child. Poetry lives in the stretch of an eyelash, the flash of a blinding light. Poetry lives in every rhyme, every melody we speak, every line, every stanza we write. One thing I try to get these kids to think about, too, and that sets up that question is I'll bring in poems like by William Carlos Williams, The Red Wheelbarrow. Mm-hmm. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. Or another small poem of his called Between Walls, the back wings of the hospital where nothing will grow, lie cinders in which shine the broken pieces of a green bottle. So I get them to say, poetry lives in these small places, the stretch of an eyelash, right? The sass of a girl's walk.
That's stunning. You know? How old was that youngster when she wrote that, roughly?
Probably sixth grade.
Wow.
But, you know, the third grade, the third graders go there, and I teach that with my university students. And
I wish I'd written something like that in my life.
I wish I'd written something like
That's stunning.
As well.
There's also a poem by Eddie Stewart called What Is a Poem? Would you share that one with us and tell us about how old this youngster was when he wrote this?
Eddie was a student of mine from grade 4 through grade 8. I had the pleasure of being the writer in residence at Marcus Garvey Academy, where I still am the writer in residence, but with him for those 4 consecutive years. And that's a question that I like to ask questions to my students. And sometimes the question is, where does poetry live? Yeah. This question that he responded to was, what is a poem? And of course, when we first start talking about what a poem is, well, a poem is something that rhymes. It's something that where we can express how we feel. Sometimes it doesn't rhyme. It looks funny on the page. It's not a paragraph. And then sometimes they spit all these great metaphors. So what is a poem by Eddie Stewart? A poem is a ball of fire lifting into the sky. No. A poem is a girl with hair long enough to climb. A poem is a car speeding down the road, going past the speed limit. A poem is a flower blooming faster than all the other flowers. No. A poem is a lesson that you will always remember. A poem is a mother bird teaching her babies how to fly. A poem is the happiest mother in the world on Mother's Day. No. A poem is a man riding a dragon saying, "This is the best day of my life." Hey, don't you know that you can rise up to become whatever you want? Did you know the world is a better place with you on it? I'm Eddie Stewart, and I want everyone to get off their feet and be as happy as you can be. Everyone, I want you to share some happy times in your life with friends. Don't be afraid. You can make a bigger difference. Remember, you are a queen bee watching over the hive.
Wow, Eddie Stewart.
Eddie is an amazing just little person and poet. And
clearly.
You know, he's a wise man dressed up as a child. You know, he reminds me of the great poet Hafiz, who says, "Our words become the house we live in." Mm. And Eddie has built this house around him that's just made out of beauty and kindness and joy.
Well, you know? It is a book that will make you feel good, I promise. Anyone who picks up this book, Inside My Pencil, Teaching Poetry in the Detroit Public Schools, you're going to walk away feeling really, really good. Peter Marcus, thank you so much for sharing your work with
us. Thank you so much for saying that.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Democrats in Lansing are taking another run at expanding the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to include sexual orientation and gender identity. Democratic State Rep John Hoadley of Kalamazoo and Senator Rebecca Warren of Ann Arbor have introduced bills expanding civil rights protection in Michigan to people who are LGBT. Here with us is attorney Dana Nessel of Detroit. She's recognized as one of the leading litigators of LGBT issues in Michigan. Dana, why does Elliot Larson need to be expanded? What's missing?
honestly, we have no protections of any kind for Michigan residents who are LGBT. So we don't have any protections for sexual orientation or for gender identity. And that's nationally true, and it's true as well for the state of Michigan. When I say nationally, I mean there's no federal law and there's no state law protections of any kind.
And indeed, are you seeing things on the national front that worry you to the point where you really are hoping we'll see this happen on the state level?
Absolutely. In fact, I think that the state is the place where this has to occur because, if anything, the few protections that existed of any kind on a federal level were really those that were imposed by the Obama administration. And all of those protections are now being rolled back by the Trump administration. The, you know, Congress has is again evaluating the Equality Act, which would create a national civil rights act. But unfortunately, with the numbers in Congress right now, that looks like it's going nowhere. And so, unfortunately, we have to revert back to the state, and we have to have some sort of rights here in the state of Michigan, or LGBT people are going to continue to suffer.
Dana, could you share an example or two of the kind of thing that happens to someone because gender identity and sexual orientation are not encoded into our law?
Well, how much time do you have? You know, because I get calls about this literally every single day. There's not a day that goes by that I don't have a same-sex couple that was evicted from their apartment, a gay or trans person that is either fired from their job once the employer finds out that they're LGBT, or denied employment in the first place. And I see, I think the scariest thing of all are the number of people that are turned away from medical treatment as a result of being gay or trans. And, I mean, I even see situations where you have same-sex couples where the doctors refuse to treat their children. So it's incredibly scary to be an LGBT person here in the state of Michigan.
There's zero recourse available for them under Michigan state law.
That's exactly right.
Now, we've seen states like North Carolina and Texas pay an economic price for discriminating against the gay and trans community. What do you think expanding Elliott Larson could mean for Michigan's economy and business climate?
Well, I think all you have to do is look at where the major corporations in this state stand. And if you look, there is a large number of Fortune 500 companies that strongly, strongly advocate amending Elliott Larson to include LGBT people. And the reason for that, it's not just because of goodwill, it's because it affects their bottom line. And the fact of the matter is, these companies know that they are unable to recruit the best talent from out of state, and they're unable to retain the best talent here in Michigan because people don't want to live and work in a state that is this backwards. And it's not just people who actually identify as LGBT. It's also people who are allies. They have a big problem with that sort of discrimination. And it's creating a lot of economic issues for our state. And that's why corporate America so badly wants to see this happen.
Dana, many who oppose laws that protect gay and trans people say that these efforts violate their rights regarding freedom of a religion. Why don't they have a point, in your view?
Well, the First Amendment has always been intended to be used as a shield and not a sword, meaning it's there to protect people and not to be utilized so that you can further your discrimination against others. And unfortunately, that's the way it's used. And I'll just give you an example of, you know, a doctor that I know who will not treat, who's a pediatrician and will not treat the children of same-sex couples. You know, to me, when you open up an office and you hold yourself out as a physician, and it is your job that in exchange for payment, you treat children, you are not being discriminated against because someone wants to pay you or utilize, you know, their insurance, which pays you, in order to medically treat their child. That's not discrimination. But that doctor refusing to treat a child based on who his or her parents are, that absolutely is discrimination. So I absolutely reject that argument.
I know 1977 is when the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act passed. It's just marked the 40th anniversary. And they have tried, what, every year since 1983 to get this expansion for gay and trans people across. And it never happens. Do you envision a day when it will?
Well, for this term, certainly, I see this as nothing more, unfortunately, than an empty gesture. Since the time period that Elliott Larson has, there have been all these efforts to amend Elliott Larson. We've had well over 1,000 legislators that have served in both the Senate and in the House and only three Republicans ever in that time period have ever stepped forward to support such legislation. Two of those Republicans are now Democrats, and the last one was Frank Foster in 2014, who got primaried out as a result of his support. So for this particular effort, we have not even a single Republican that has stepped forward to indicate his or her support for this. So unfortunately, I don't see this happening right now. The only way that I could possibly see an amendment coming through the legislature is, frankly, if we see a change in the gerrymandering in the state, because I think even for Republicans, the legislature is not reflective of how the general public sees this issue. And we know from polling data that literally 70% of all Michigan residents support equal rights for LGBT people. Unfortunately, the legislature doesn't reflect that because we're seeing the most far-right people who end up winning their primaries, and again, because of gerrymandering, that's permitted to occur. So until we do something about redistricting, I don't really see anything happening through the legislature. I actually see the best opportunity for an amendment to Elliot Larson through a ballot proposal.
Attorney Dana Nessel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
If you miss any part of today's show, it's really easy for you to find it on our podcast. Just head to michiganradio.org, click on podcasts to find the link.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Hiding people in barns, stowing people in secret rooms while keeping the watchful eyes of law enforcement and bounty hunters away from their clandestine activities. That's our image of Michiganders who helped thousands of escaping slaves through the Underground Railroad. But there are many, many more dimensions to the Underground Railroad in Michigan. Historian Michelle S. Johnson has made it her mission to help us more fully understand Michigan's role in the Underground Railroad. Michelle S. Johnson, pleasure to welcome you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Tell us, when did the Underground Railroad begin to operate in Michigan? Were we even a state yet?
Oh, well, no. People were escaping here, you know, far before we became a state. One of the most popular incidents are the Blackburns, Lucy and Thornton Blackburn, who had escaped here in the 30s and were the subject of a very intense debate between Canada and Michigan. And this was right on the eve of our statehood. And in fact, many ways defined us. So people had been escaping here, and people had also been not always just escaping slavery, but escaping segregation and racial inequality in places like North Carolina and Virginia and Indiana and Ohio, sometimes people who had their freedom for three generations. And so they were then coming to this area because the codes against people who were of color or black at that time, they were being pushed out and it was becoming unsafe. So you have a very interesting mixture of black folks that are coming to here to Michigan pre-statehood and afterward.
So did that mean some folks were making Michigan their final stop while others needed to get across to Canada?
Absolutely. And it's never really so cut and dry because people are kind of going back and forth in many cases between Michigan and Canada, depending on the political climate here in the state. And
which was very fluid.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you see, especially in places like Detroit, a lot of movement between these two places of Detroit and what they called Sandwich, Ontario at the time. And so, yes, people are doing all of that. They're here at times, and they are like many people who come to Michigan seeking a place of safety, seeking a place that they can live out their lives. And they're coming here oftentimes, you know, one of the most common perceptions about the Underground Railroad is that there were these routes. You see these maps all the time.
You do. I
spent 10 years trying to refute this notion of the route.
So particularly give us the straight talk.
Because it's really about pulses of activity. So like I said, these families are moving from Kentucky together. They're moving from Virginia together or North Carolina. They've known each other. They've married each other. They've been, in some cases, they have lived on similar plantations if they're escaping from slavery or nearby plantations. So people are operating out of networks of religion, out of politics, out of family, out of culture, and they are bringing those networks with them, and they're tapping into and creating and further solidifying those networks when they get here. So they're not like, oh, I'm going to start in here in Kentucky, then I'm going to go up through Indiana, and then I'm going to stop in Madison. You know, it's mm-hmm. not like that. It's not like kind of laying out your, you know, you don't not laying out your route that says you're going to go right exactly.
Yeah.
And so what you see then are these like pulses of activity in these particular locations that when you have a decent population of Black people in these various places in Michigan, it speaks to a notion of having safe space created for these folks. And so that's not to say that you don't see places like, oh, goodness, even Allegan County, for mm-hmm. instance, where you see like, you know, maybe a handful of Black folks there. It's not like Cass County where you have enormous populations of Black people starting in the 1840s, 1850s. Wayne County, of course. Washtenaw County as well. And then you have these little blips like up in Sheboygan where in 1860 you've got a large number of Black folks. And you also find even in 1860 in Allegan, in Van Buren County here in Michigan, these little pockets of folks in Ionia, for goodness sakes. So many places that we don't typically think of Black people in the landscape. And so that's what's really exciting about this project is to be able to repopulate the imaginary landscape and the physical landscape with all of these people that were functioning in so many different kinds of ways.
And in kind of overturning that image that it was more white people who were pro-abolition who
yes.
would hide someone in their cellar
right,
and
right.
then the
oh,
word
gosh.
Would get out. So
right,
that
right.
isn't really what it was. There were some
I mean, there are certainly people yeah. who secreted, there were white people who secreted African-American folks or Black folks in their escape. Say for instance, James Bonine and Stephen Bogue in Cass County. Stephen Bogue, that we have very solid documentation for him secreting Perry Sanford, who had escaped from Kentucky with a group of folks and then come and they're settling in Cass County and in an area that was known then as Young's Prairie and folks have come to know it as Ramptown. But what we see happening here is these Quakers that, you know, quite frequently people like to represent Quakers as, you know, they were these really benevolent people that just didn't believe in slavery and they were such good people. And yes, that was true in some part. But also Quakers were divided on what position people should take in relationship to slavery. Should you just let God work it out? Mm. Or should you access a more radical political
proactive.
Strategy? Exactly. And so
yes.
people were debating in that. And also didn't mean that because you were a white Quaker that you really believed that Black people were equal to you. Mm. You have people like Laura Haviland, who was someone who is one of our kind of primary folks who started the Raisin Institute in Adrian and Lenawee County and became quite well known for her anti-slavery activist, but also said that she didn't think that we were necessarily intellectually equal.
Was the Underground Railroad, air quotes here, was it controversial in Michigan then, perhaps in the same way sanctuary cities are controversial in 2017?
Well, I mean, oh my goodness, there were so many debates going on about, and so, you know, these communities, while there are people, say, for instance, it's in Marshall or Washtenaw County or Wayne County, you still have people who are descendants of people who claim ownership over folks. You know, you've got a lot of white Kentuckians that believe in the South, in Michigan, and still probably do. And so they were very hotly debated. But what I've always been really impressed about is particularly because this notion of like covert action becomes such a central idea that people put forward about the Underground Railroad. Everything had to be secretive. You know, you had to have these safe houses and safe rooms that nobody knew about. People in Michigan were outright vocal about their anti-slavery activists. You have people in Washtenaw County putting a sign in their yard saying, you know, people are welcome here. You've got people publishing, like the Colored Citizens of Detroit, publishing in newspapers saying, we will do what we, you know, by any means necessary, we will help people. That people are very vocal. The barbers across the state of Michigan are like George Miller in Battle Creek. He's sending, when the Civil War breaks out, he sends a letter to the Secretary of War and says, you know, I've got 1,000 sharpshooters ready to go of a combination of Black people and what he calls quote unquote half-breed Indians. And if you don't want us to serve as sharpshooters, we will go as guerrilla soldiers. And this is in 1860. 61. So, wow, right? This is a very different story of people who are very overt about their resistance.
Now, Michelle, I know this weekend you're partnering with the Society for History and Racial Equity, SHARE,
yes,
spotlighting the Underground Railroad in Southwest Michigan. So tell us about this event and especially why Southwest Michigan is so key to this history.
Oh, sure. Well, we're so excited about this event. The tour has been going on, oh, goodness, I don't know, probably about 8 years or so.
And when the tour
of these locations connected to the Underground Railroad and resistance to slavery, because sometimes they're two mm-hmm. different things, although aligned. And so it really emerged out of a production that Denise Miller put together, oh, man, like 12 years ago or something. And what it is it's a series of primary documents that we've located connected to the Underground Railroad and resistance to slavery, really centralizing individual stories and their accounts of either escape or resistance or standing up or and from a wide variety of perspectives. And then she does incredible persona poem that Denise Miller does, where she kind of takes on the voice of the folks in this production. But Southwest Michigan, as you mentioned, is really important because there was such a heavy population of black people there in the areas of Niles and Dowagiac and Cass County that really kind of counters these understandings that we have of largely urban black people and largely urban black settlements. So we get to see really a very sizable population of people who are farming and holding vast acreage in this area. And so that creates a unique story to Southwest Michigan.
Well, all you have to do to find out more about the Southwest Michigan Underground Railroad Tour this Saturday from 8:30 until 5:30 is go to sharekazoo.org. Michelle S. Johnson works with the Michigan History Center, and she's an authority on the African-American experience in Michigan. And she'll be taking people on the Southwest Michigan Underground Railroad Tour this Saturday. Thank you for sharing your passion with us.
Thank you for hearing us. We're so excited about it. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.